This summarizes what really the World Health Organization has said about road traffic injuries. They affect disproportionately the vulnerable groups in society. And vulnerable groups are defined as pedestrians, people who are on motorcycles and cyclists. Often people misunderstand and they believe that people who really get injured in road accidents are passengers and drivers and that sort of thing. Especially in developing economies, they affect people who are more vulnerable in society, and particularly the poor. I think one of the reports that was issued said that more than half of the people killed are young adults. You'll see in the slides that are going to be coming, and often breadwinners. Now, and what is even key, though, is they affect low-income and middle-income countries. It costs about 1 to 2% of gross national product of low-income and middle-income countries are caused by road accident funds, by road accidents annually. Now, this is a big amount, and I think it's an area that requires attention. And by the way, in the World Health Organization classifies South Africa as a middle-income country. So, but you can see up to 2% of gross national product is a hefty amount. Just some background information. I see this slide is not coming out that clearly in the top here. Of all the injuries, the deaths that are caused by injuries, 22.8% of people who die as a result of injuries arise out of injuries in road accidents. And this is a large number. So compared to violence, suicide, and drowning, and this sort of thing, even war, it's quite amazing that we have war throughout the world, Iraq and all those sort of places. But road accident funds still by far kill more people, road accidents. And this is an updated report that was issued earlier this year by the World Health Organization. They currently state that road accidents are the number 9 causes of death and throughout the world. Number 9 causes of death and disease throughout the world. So, I mean, they're just 3 levels below HIV. But what is interesting is that unless attention is given to road accident injuries, it will surpass HIV and AIDS to become the number 5 biggest cause of death throughout the world. So these are startling facts that WHO has issued this year. But there is an update that they issued this year. In the past, they used to say that it was going to go all the way to number 3, but currently it's number 5. So it shows how serious this problem is. If you have regard to the age, people who are affected by road accidents, you will see that between 5 and 14-year-olds, people who pass away, people who die, road accidents are number 2 cause of death. Among people who are aged between 15 and 29 years, it's the number 1 cause of death, and all the way up to age 44. So you can see that most of the people who are active in society, who are breadwinners, really their life is cut short by road accidents. Interesting that in the same report that you have statistics on South Africa. And South Africa is right up there in Africa in terms of the number of people who die on road accidents per a population of 100,000. We are right at the top, despite the fact that relative to the rest of countries within the continent, we should be having better infrastructure and that sort of thing. So we are experiencing 33.2 deaths per population of 100,000, according to the report of WHO. And in fact, we are on the top 10 worldwide in countries including developed economies, on the number of people who die on the roads. So as a country, there's a hang of a lot of ways that we have to go in looking at this gauge. And again, just background information, you look at people who, the proportion, the distribution of people who get affected. We have passengers representing in South Africa 56% of people who die in road accidents, and pedestrians 39%. So between passengers and pedestrians, this is where the biggest impact is. So I think when the committee was focusing on public transport about 2 weeks ago on buses and that sort of thing, I think we were pleased to see that, because this is one of the areas where we need attention. But I think one area where the World Health Organization indicates that very little attention is given is red on pedestrians. And this is in designing infrastructure, whether it's roads or planning and that sort of thing. And we do need to give attention also to pedestrians on our roads. And just, again, background statistics. And these are statistics provided by Road Traffic Management Corporation for January to December last year. You can see the proportion of passengers and pedestrians are still relatively high. And to say that we are losing 38 people per day is really, I think, in terms of society, it's just a little too much. So this is just a contextual framework, but why does this affect the Road Accident Fund? The key for us is that we are actually a mirror on the success or failure of some of the policies and programs that we as a government and I think as an economy are addressing this problem. That's because we do not only pay for people who die on our roads, we also pay for people who are injured on South African roads. And so at EMIRA, our success, the financial position of the Road Accident Fund in some way reflects whether our policies are successful or not. But just by way of background, what is it that we as the fund are doing? What is our business? I know we really misunderstood in terms of the nature of our business. In simple terms, all we do is provide peace of mind. In effect, what we're saying to South African public or anybody who finds themselves on South African roads, we are saying that there may be uncertainty in life. And the uncertainty may arise in the fact that as you wake up and you go about your normal chores, you may find yourself on the road and you may have an unfortunate incident that you can either get injured or die as a result of a car accident. Now, what we do is we provide cover. We provide cover to everybody who finds themselves injured in the road. Now, it's insurance cover, but in reality, the cover that we're providing is we're saying, should your body be broken, should your bones and your organs be broken, we will go and assist you. So we don't cover the metals and the car and the vehicles and that sort of thing. So even if you're a pedestrian, we're providing you with peace of mind that should anything happen to you, you will be covered. Now, the type of cover is the two types of cover that we're providing. One is indemnity cover. What we're saying to somebody who caused the accident is that you will be indemnified from paying the cost of the injuries that you caused somebody else. So in effect, you'll say if you harm somebody and in law you were required to compensate them or to heal them, you do not have to do so. The Road Accident Fund will step in your shoes. And in fact, this is where the concept of third-party compensation came in, where the Road Accident Fund stepped into the shoes of the wrongdoer. But we also provide a second type of cover, and that is compensation to victims and their families in circumstances where they do get injured or for some reason they pass away. And we look, when we look at the benefits that we provide, that to the victims who will pay their medical costs, the future loss of income and that sort of thing, to the family we pay a lot for support, but we'll deal with that in a little bit of detail later. But this is not just insurance cover. And by the way, the insurance policy is written in the legislation that governs the Road Accident Fund. So, you know, a lot of people, a lot of South Africans don't even know that they have insurance policy that is issued because they don't see the policy. This policy is written in the law. It tells you how you pay for the cover and what benefits you get. And it is this law that makes up the insurance policy. But it is compulsory in the sense that all South Africans are covered. And I keep saying South Africans, it includes anybody who finds themselves in the road, foreigner, illegal immigrants, everybody who finds themselves in the road is covered. But it is social insurance in the sense that not everybody contributes, so there's payment through fuel levy. Not everybody contributes, but it's social insurance. So if you're a 5-year-old child who may not have directly contributed to this social insurance, you are nevertheless covered. So you can see our customer base is 49.3 million South Africans, all foreign visitors, and this number will increase, and immigrants, legal and illegal immigrants, are covered. And just as a reminder, and we'll talk about some of the weaknesses in this regard, it doesn't matter that you spend a day in South Africa or a week. In fact, when we paid the 500 million claim to Shosh, the Swiss national who visited South African shores, he had intended to be here only for 3 weeks. And in fact, the premium that he paid in terms of the fuel that he put in Harley-Davidson didn't even exceed 100 rand. But he got compensation of 500 million. So we do cover foreigners as well. And really, this is the transaction. Everybody pays, when I say everybody, every commuter pays for this cover. And in the terms of fuel levy, currently it's sitting at 64 cents a litre. And then for in exchange for that cover, you get indemnity and compensation. Just by way of background, there's been improvement in the collection of fuel levy over the years. I think those of us who are old enough will recall that we didn't always have fuel levy system in the country. But when you registered your car, you used to get private sector insurance company issue you with the third party disc that you stuck on your car window. And you needed to renew it annually. Over the years, there were a number of problems with those third party discs. In the sense that, in the same way that we currently had a problem with unregistered vehicles on our roads and that sort of thing, we had situations where certain motorists would not renew the cover, the license discs. So often when they got involved in accidents, we ran into the same problems that we had in the past where there was no insurance cover. So fuel levy was introduced to come and substitute for some of those weaknesses in the sense that it ensured that everybody was covered. And I think about 2 years ago, we moved the collection of the fuel levy all the way from retail and wholesale to the refineries. So currently, as the fuel leaves the refinery, the fuel levy on the RAS is charged. And it's now collected by South African Revenue Service, whereas in the past the collection was done by the Central Energy Fund. And by the way, one of the things that the SARS do take out is something called diesel rebate. A diesel rebate is for those industries like people who run tractors on farms or people who use either petrol or diesel in the factories. They're entitled to go to SARS and say, sorry, I may have paid fuel levy, but I did not use the fuel levy on the road. I used it to run my tractor, to farm, or to run my business. So they get given a refund, and that refund is getting closer to 1 billion rand annually. And Argentina. This is just briefly some of the claim process. In terms of claiming, the law doesn't prohibit people from claiming directly from the road accident fund. In fact, people are entitled, South Africans or any accident victim is entitled to claim directly from the arrears. The one thing that we are experiencing is that more than 90% of our claims come through attorneys, and we'll explain why that is so. So this basically, by way of background, what's our business? The mandate of the arrears that is defined in the Act is the one that's on the screen there. It says that the object of the fund shall be the payment of compensation in accordance with this Act for loss or damage wrongfully caused by the driving of motor vehicle. This is the definition that introduces fault. It says that we will only pay compensation if the loss or damage is wrongfully caused by the driving of a motor vehicle. So to the extent that somebody caused the accident, then they're not entitled to compensation. So if you're the wrongdoer and you are the cause of the accident, that's in effect what's been happening. Now, we don't always, we have different schemes throughout the world. There are schemes that are no-fault schemes, and there are schemes that are fault-based schemes. There are difficulties with no-fault schemes or fault-based schemes, which we'll define in a little detail later. But I think this is where part of the problem started with the arrears, that in fact we're spending a lot more time. We spend a disproportionate amount of time determining who was at fault at the end of the accident, as opposed to going and helping those accident victims get the care they deserve. It really is a problem. If somebody is lying there on the street and bleeding and needing medical attention, instead of us being entitled to go and help them and ensure that they get as much care as they can, as quickly as they can, the difficulty is if we were to do that, we will be doing something that is illegal, because our law says we are only supposed to assist if we have determined fault, and that's one of the areas that really is cheating South Africans of benefits that they're entitled to. And again, we'll deal with it in a little more detail when we look at it later on. This is the nature of the compensation that we're covering. So what we pay past and future medical and related expenses. So in reality, what we're saying to the accident victim is that if you break your leg, we will pay only the cost. We're not supposed to pay more or less. We're supposed to pay exactly how much it costs you in medical and related expenditure. And that's the reason we talk about related expenditure is that often in claiming there are medical legal reports and all those sort of stuff. So we pay all of those. And if you're a paraplegic, as an example, we will pay to fix your house, to go convert your vehicle into a sort of paraplegic vehicle. If you need a lift in your house as a result of the accident, we do pay for some of those related expenditures. We pay funeral expenses, past and future loss of support. Loss of support is used to describe an area where someone was a breadwinner. If somebody was a breadwinner and they pass away, their families should extend that the breadwinner's income is no longer there to compensate them. We do pay loss of support to the families of the breadwinners. We pay past and future loss of earnings. If you are just injured and you haven't passed away, and something called general damages. What general damages are, there's various terms for it, loss of amenities of life. We normally call them story money. What we're saying is, having compensated you for losing your job, losing your income, and all your medical costs, we feel sorry, and then we give you a little bit more. And this is one area, in fact, that where a lot of abuse has occurred. Because if you think about our social objective, we're supposed to do two things as a road accident fund. We're supposed to go and reintegrate victims of motor vehicle accidents back into society from a health point of view and from an economic point of view. What we're saying, though, is he used to be economically active, and instead he used to be healthy, and suddenly, as a result of a motor vehicle accident, you're no longer healthy. We're supposed to go and ensure that you get back into society by as quickly as possible paying and fixing you medically. But to the extent that you lose your income, let's say you used to, to have a full paying employment that require you to use your hands or your legs and that sort of thing, and suddenly you don't have those, we're supposed to compensate you. And those are really the two social objectives that we're supposed to achieve. But what happened with general damages, and you'll see the numbers, we're spending just over $5 billion a year in general damages. And those figures will come in a little while. This is money that we pay for people who are not really injured. In reality, general damages should be paid to individuals that are seriously injured. And we'll talk about it later. If you think about it carefully, is that if somebody used to walk to the office or used to walk to a bus or a taxi or drive to the office, and suddenly they become paraplegic. They lose some of the amenities of life and the enjoyment of life and running around and all this sort of stuff. General damages, often is justifiable in that sense. But in reality, what's happening is people who have bumper beating accidents, tiny little bumper beating accidents, where somebody actually walks away with a scratch, or they say they've been shocked that there's a lot of an accident and this sort of thing, and then they claim from us. We are paying disproportionately a large amount of money in general damages compared to income, as you'll see later. In fact, what we're paying, last year we paid about 11 billion rand in total in compensation. What we paid in medical costs, which is in reality what the REF is here for, is less than a billion rand. And what we paid in sorry money is over 5 billion rand. And it really is a big leakage in our scheme, as you'll see later. And our vision is obviously to make sure that we provide the right sort of cover for South Africans. And we want to focus on rehabilitating and promoting safe use of our roads and that sort of thing. So I won't go through the values and the mission, but just briefly on the scheme, what is wrong with the scheme? Why is it that we've had 7 commissions of inquiry by successive governments in this country into third-party compensation? Something has to be wrong with the scheme. There's a few issues that really are fundamentally wrong with the scheme. Firstly, the scheme is exceptionally complex. Very, very complex. And only South African really cannot go and successfully claim on their own from the REF, because they have to traverse complex legal, hurdles before they have a successful claim in the REF. And this is what is initially unfair about the scheme, because everybody, all South Africans, pay fuel levy, so you are paying for this compensation that you're getting. But when you have to claim from us, you have to go and prove fault. And I can tell you, you could be a nuclear scientist, you could be, an accountant, a chartered accountant. To come and claim and prove fault is exceptionally complex. Even lawyers who are not specialists in third-party compensation, find it difficult to claim from the scheme. It is exceptionally complex. And this is one of the failings of the fund, and it's one of the reasons why it takes so long for claimants to claim from us. That's why this scheme is so inaccessible to ordinary South Africans. Very complex. The second issue is it's subjective. This scheme is so subjective. An example of this is if you're a 5-year-old kid and you're claiming from the fund, rather than the REF saying you're entitled to a set fixed amount, that's not what we do. What we're saying is we're going to have to go and determine what you're going to be throughout your life. So So we're saying at 5-year-old, what education you're going to get, what choices you're going to make. Are you going to become a doctor? Are you going to become a lawyer? Are you going to become a scientist? Are you going to become Bill Gates? And not only that, and look at your career for the rest of your life. And to be quite honest, crystal ball gazing is a little bit more exact than the scheme here. And now you have experts around the scheme who think that they know what you're going to become. It's a 5-year-old kid. They know what you're going to become when you grow up and this sort of thing. And all of this starts adding cost to administering the scheme. Not only cost, time. It takes just far too long for us to pay claims. But it adds another element. It adds inequities. It perpetuates historical imbalances of the past. As an example, a 5-year-old kid who has as a parentage, say a gardener as a dad or a maid as a mom, what these experts are going to say, and what they often say, is that that's what your future career is going to be. That in fact, for the rest of your life, you're also going to become. You'll never get a degree. You're also going to become a gardener, or you're also going to become a maid for the rest of your life. And as such, your income earning capabilities is limited. In fact, often I put myself in those shoes and I say, you know, as I grew up, none of the experts would ever have thought that I was going to be CEO of the Road Accident Fund. Everybody was going to be saying, this is an income earning capacity because, you know, your parents didn't get this education. You also will never get the education and that sort of thing. And really, it's exceptionally unfair to South African population. And in fact, it's one of the schemes where the poor subsidizes the rich. In most cases, you have schemes where the rich subsidize the poor, but this case, the poor subsidize the rich. And this happens this way. Everybody pays the same level of hill levy. 64 cents, everybody pays. Whether you're somebody from this suit, who's catching a taxi because indirectly it's in your taxi fare or in your bus fare, or whether you're an executive in a large organization earning millions of rand, you pay the same fuel levy. However, when it comes to compensation, the rich get more than you do. If you're somebody who just happened to live in this suit and that sort of thing. So your benefits are limited because of your circumstances, and the rich actually get more. And really, it's a scheme that needs fixing. There are a lot of institutional frameworks that are not in place that needs to be fixed. I think there are certain elements that we've done right and elements that we've done wrong. When we introduced hill levy as an example, we forgot that we actually are a monopoly in the country. That instead we needed to put all the necessary institutions in place, for instance, to determine the right amount of hill levy. We should have had, say, a regulator like NERSA or ICASA and that sort of thing in this industry that not only protects the interests of the public but ensures that the fund is appropriately funded, that the hill levy is set at the right level. And we don't have some of those institutions. The scheme is not affordable. You know, when we settled the claim of Joachim Schorsch in Switzerland, Switzerland, one of the things we wanted to determine is whether he was going to be entitled to the same benefits. And he lives in a first world economy. And in fact, often we go and talk to reinsurers in London who are obviously taking up the big flag in our claim. They are actually amazed that a tiny developing economy like South Africa, a tiny developing economy like South Africa compared to those first world economies, is so generous in this area that in fact we could be paying ₹500 billion to one individual as a developing economy when first world economies would never pay that kind of money. And they actually don't understand why South Africa is so generous, and I think the scheme is definitely not affordable to to the economy. You'll see when you look at the financial statements later that we're sitting with a 40 billion rand hole. 40 billion rand hole. This despite the fact that Parliament gave us an extra 2.5 billion last year. And one of the problems, though, is we haven't taken the right political decision to plug the holes. This scheme is leaking, and money is really wasted. Money is wasted daily. Every day, every month, area we pay close to a billion rand. Close to a billion rand in compensation. And it really breaks my heart. Every time I look at this and I say, close to 600 million of that money doesn't reach accident victims. 600 million of that money doesn't reach accident victims. It just, in my mind, is wasted. And it's a scheme that can be fixed. And it really is not affordable to South Africa. It costs too much, cost of administration. And you'll see when you see the figures later that of the 64 cents still levy that is paid, to think that more than half of it goes into administration, we're paying legal costs, expert costs, and all those sort of things. And we're paying for people who are not really injured in general damages. Jesus, that money could be going to the poor. But the cost of administration is too high. There's also a lot of abuse on the system. That example with soft tissue injuries, people who are not genuinely injured, who get a tiny little bumper beating accident. In fact, their car is only scratched, tiny, got tiny little scratches. They come and claim general damages from us. And because medical doctors have got no way of determining if your bone is not broken, whether a sore muscle is really a genuine injury. There is actually is abuse in the system. But I think one of the other problems is the legislation has not been an enabler. I think our legislation went a little bit too far. Even the claim form is written in the law, so we cannot even keep up with modern changes in technology and this sort of thing. To change anything, we have to go through legislation. And we won't go through some of this in detail because we do not even take some of the socio-political aims of government into account. You look at some of the countries, our neighboring countries, for instance, they'll say on medical treatment, they'll say your first preference is that if you get injured in South Africa, you get medical treatment here. Don't go and say you're going to get medical treatment in America or in Britain or in some first world economy. Our scheme doesn't say so. Obviously, there have been amendments to the scheme that are putting limitations. You could get injured here and you could get treatment anywhere in the world. And we pay you in your own foreign currency, American dollars, or Swiss francs, and euros, and that sort of thing. So we don't have certain of these policies that we ought to have, even policies on legal immigrants. Certain jurisdictions will say if you're illegal in South Africa or you get involved in an accident committing a crime, we will still save your life, so we will pay for your medical costs. But we're not going to go and pay for your loss of earnings and loss of income and all those sort of stuff. And we don't do those sort of things. And there's often challenges to this. Every time we try and put caps, and by the way, worldwide there are caps that are put in place on some of the schemes in certain areas. There's always constitutional issues that are raised that we are interfering with access to the courts, as an example, when you put a 160,000 limit, it's unconstitutional. In reality, the constitution does allow for limitation to be imposed if it is reasonable and it's justifiable in an open and democratic society. So we're quite satisfied that some of the changes that I think this committee is going to be engaged in as we move to the new scheme. Will also pass constitutional master. And just briefly, this is our history. We haven't had any illustrious history. 7 commissions of inquiry and really no change is really sad. And some of them, as early as the 1950s, we've had 7 commissions of inquiry by successive governments. The new government had its commission of inquiry in 2002. It made certain recommendations. It definitely recommended that we have a no-fault scheme, and we're still working on the scheme. So, but what is required is your very political will to make the changes for South Africa. But what went wrong in the past? I think to understand road accidents, you have to understand what really it is. Road accidents are a negative consequence of economic development. In effect, it's almost like pollution and that sort of thing. You know, as economies grow and develop and that sort of thing, people have become more mobile, they use more cars, and so, you know, we have increases in accidents. But the solution that we put in place was really an inappropriate solution to what was more a socio-economic problem. And what we mean is this, is that we went and took what has been happening in the courts, this common law of delict, and we created an institution around it. We just said, there's a law out there, law of delict, this is how people pay one another. And there were problems in the past in society in the sense that two things were happening before, you know, third-party compensation came in. Individuals used to go and get injured in motor vehicle accidents and never really get compensation because, you know, it actually started with when we started to have cheap cars. And, you know, and here I've got, you know, Ford Model T and that sort of thing where middle-income individuals could afford cars. The problem, though, is they didn't have the money to pay compensation to somebody who really was injured. So if today somebody were to run over, say, one of the soccer stars next year in the World Cup, David Beckham or whoever the case is, they would never be able to afford paying David Beckham. So they would either go belly up and become insolvent and this sort of thing. But Beckham himself would never be able to afford. Basically, he became paraplegic. The income and the career would actually change. So we did have all these problems with insolvencies and inadequate relief. But more importantly, people who are injured in accidents become a burden to society in the sense that they go and now require additional health benefits and for the rest of their lives. So having a team is the right thing. The only problem, though, is we didn't do it the right way. And by the way, you can have successful fault-based schemes in the world. No fault is not necessarily the panacea for everything. Obviously, no fault does two things. It reduces the time it takes for accident victims to get compensation and to get attention. Our first preference would be as a road accident fund. If somebody is involved in an accident, we don't want to ask questions. We don't want to say, who was at fault? Who was doing this and that sort of thing? We want to go and help that accident victim. We want to go and make sure that the ambulance picks them up, takes them to hospital. At the moment, it doesn't happen. And that's why we prefer a sort of a no-fault scheme as opposed to that. But we also we'd like a scheme that is not subjective. And by the way, schemes, fault-based schemes, that are successful throughout the world are schemes that are not subjective. I think there's a misconception in, I think, around the REF that most of the court cases surround the issue of merit, who was at fault. And in fact, almost close to 90% of the cases that we deal with quantum. Quantum meaning how much should somebody be paid? Because everybody thinks that either the son or the daughter is going to become a Michael Jackson and this sort of thing. And we argue about things like that in court, and we just waste expenses. So you can have successful no-fault schemes as long as some of the structure of the compensation is appropriate. And just quickly in summary, Satchwell Commission identified four big problems with the scheme, and by the way, this commission was adopted, I think, elements of it by cabinet at the time, that the scheme is unsustainable, it's inequitable, it's unreasonable and unaffordable for some of the reasons that I indicated in there. You know, the disparities between the rich and the poor, the rural and the urban, and unemployed and employed victims just gets exacerbated. The high settlement costs, you know, the poor are subsidizing the rich and all those sort of issues that I've mentioned. So we need a scheme that will focus on accident prevention, rehabilitation, and ensuring that the benefits are not subjective and that it provides appropriate cover. The Amendment Act that came into being in 1st of August 2008 was just an initial attempt at addressing some of the problems. It doesn't quite address the real problems. It's reducing, for instance, some of the discriminatory laws that were in place. You know, some of them, for instance, related to limitation on passengers whose lengths were limited to 25,000 rands. And those limitations have been reduced, removed completely. Lots of incoming support is limited to 160,000 as an example. We do have new tariffs, two tariffs, one for emergency treatment, one for non-emergency. And we're beginning to say general damages must be paid only for serious injuries. And we've experienced emotional shock. I think one of the problems we've had in the country is that somebody could be sitting on the window in their office, hear screech marks outside, look out the window, and see two cars colliding, and come to the front and say, "Oh, I'm shocked. I just saw two cars colliding outside of my window." It's called emotional shock, and claim from us. That's how ridiculous the scheme has been. So that one has now been excluded. So that's briefly, you know, what has been our business and some of the challenges that we're facing. And just a rescue plan, we've engaged about 3 years ago, the minister obviously signed a rescue plan where we said we have to fix things. And I think the key message in this is we cannot do it alone. We have a scheme that is engraved in the law. So the business model is in legislation. So we're going to need this committee, we're going to need Parliament, we're going to need the Department of Transport, and everybody else to help us in fixing in the scheme for ordinary South Africans. But these are some of the challenges that we identified: inability to process claims, high cost of administration, some of them we've spoken about, prevalence of fraud. And by the way, fraud here is misunderstood. In as it relates to RES, we actually suffer two types of fraud. One of it we call systemic fraud and opportunistic fraud. In reality, opportunistic fraud is much, much less. And opportunistic fraud arises where your system and processes are so weak that people can come and take advantage of you. And that's opportunistic. Systemic fraud is where the biggest fraud is happening. This is where the system has got so many loopholes that people get entitled to claim, even in areas where under no circumstances they wouldn't be entitled to claim. And this is where we see it in general damages. Whereas that people who are not really injured, for instance, go to a doctor and say, "My neck is sore." And then they get paid millions and hundreds of thousands of rands. And this really is systemic fraud. And that's the one that we need to address through legislation. And then our model is really unsustainable. And we've actually suffered years of underfunding, as we'll see later. We did develop a rescue plan action where we wanted to eliminate the backlog and look at fixing the model. We actually had timelines where we said we needed to clear the backlog within 5 years, reduce cost to 33%. But the key ones are the ones that really need attention is changing the economic model. You know, this scheme can really serve the poor, it can really serve South Africans if the model itself were changed, and it would require legislation to change that model. There were three approaches that we put forward. I mean, we prepared an aggressive approach where we would clear the backlog in a very short space of time. I think one of the problems that we faced was funding, that we didn't have sufficient cash to go clear the backlog as quickly as we could. But also, I think because we hadn't really plugged the holes in terms of changes in the legislation that we require. So we've been actually following a more balanced approach. Now, in terms of our rescue plan, there's a few elements to it. There's certain areas that we look at internally as the RES, where we're going to change systems and processes and that sort of thing, and you'll see later progress that we've done. By the way, Rotary Credit Fund used to operate no different from a law firm. When we process a claim, we create a file that is legal to, you know, a legal file where you take notes and that sort of thing, and that's not how the business was supposed to be run. And a claim handler was a jack of all trades. They would handle calls and, you know, and process hundreds and hundreds of claims. Now the system has changed completely. We actually have almost a conveyor belt type scheme, which will allow for claims to be processed much quicker. But however, the bottom one, where we needed to redesign the model, engage government on funding, and pursue legislative amendments, those are really what is going to break the back of what is the cancer in our society currently. This is the process that we said we're going to follow in terms of delivering the new model. And you'll see later that we actually are going to be converging in terms of processing claims through the new model, and then also working on legislative amendments. Most of the elements, the building blocks in our turnaround, especially the internal ones, are in place. We did the diagnostics that indicated what was wrong. In fact, we started with the blank sheet of paper and said, if we wanted to run this business, how would it run? And we scoured the world and said, road accidents are a global problem, and they are seen throughout the world. We are not the only organization in the world that's dealing with this problem. We wanted to learn how they do things and that sort of thing, and that's how we came with a diagnostic model. And we think that the model that we have in place really compares with all the other models throughout the world. So most of the elements are in place, and we're actually about to roll out the new claims administration system beginning in October, in about 2 months' time. And for as long as we have a no-fault scheme, you know, one of the difficulties that we've had, a fault-based scheme, one of the difficulties that we've had is that as a road accident fund, we would hear of an accident happening today. And by the way, daily, as all of us go to the office and that sort of thing, you listen to the radio, you'll hear of a traffic problem with an accident happening somewhere. But rather than become proactive, we would wait and wait. And often we wait for 3 years before somebody lodges a claim with us. And because it's based on fault, evidence starts disappearing and all those sort of things. To go to a police station after 3 years after the accident and say, what happened, you know, on Sunday night at 12 o'clock midnight in 2005, and to go and go find out who was there, who were the witnesses, really is not on. And that's where, in fact, advantage has been taken of the area. So some of our systems allows us to get engaged right at the beginning in all those processes before the claim is lodged with us. In the past, we used to wait for the claim to be lodged with us. So that's our approach. Three elements to it. The board and management, we wanted to fix our systems internally. This committee, Parliament, Department of Transport, we really have to introduce a scheme that is looks after the interests of ordinary South Africans. And that's our treasury. We wanted them to set up, obviously, a scheme that's fully capitalized. So those were the three building blocks that we're working on. Just how far are we doing, you know, having had 3 years from this? Just systems and processes. I think the RAF is getting to be gradually, I think from October onwards, it's going to be unrecognizable to the way it used to be in the past. We now have become a little more customer-centric. We're looking after the interests of the customers. We've set up our scheme in a manner where we want now to have the customer have an experience with the RAF. At the moment, if somebody gets involved in an accident, the only person they engage in is lawyers. And the way we've been running with the RAF is that the poor accident victims become a number or documents on pieces of paper. We want to feel their pain. We want to be able to engage with them. And in fact, average staff members have never really met an accident victim. You have staff members who've worked at the RAF for 7, 8, 10 years who've never physically seen an accident victim. And all they see is pieces of paper, and they negotiate as if they, with I think plenty of attorneys, as if they negotiated to buy a car, you know, on somebody's personal life. And that's one of the things that we want to change. And, you know, and we're changing our customer service network. We used to not have offices throughout the country. For some reason, over the years, it really didn't make sense that RAF didn't cover the entire country, because accidents do happen in Kokstad, in Mafikeng, in Lydenburg, in Nelspruit. For us to only have offices, you know, in the major cities really didn't make sense. But one of the things that we actually have that we're going to do is not only expand our footprint, is look at the centralized processing model and make sure that our customer-facing offices really look after the interests of the customers. And we'll talk about this later. And currently, we've now started with a few hospital service points. We now have presence in provincial hospitals, about 48 of them. Our aim is to make sure that we grow that to 128. So for those customers who get wheeled into hospitals, we want to start originating their claims there. We don't want for them to wait until TAUs come to them and come and claim from the area. So we have just in that slide an indication of where we are and where we're going in the next couple of years. We changed our claim processes completely. We want customers to be able to claim from face-to-face, voice, electronic, even through their tenants, because we still have a fall-based scheme. And our customer contact centers are meant to our customer contact centers are meant to allow customers to claim directly from us, from hospitals through the internet. And then we're going to be processing claims centrally. We're going to be linking with third parties, as you'll see later. And IT is going to become an important base in what we're going to be doing. So we've got an indication of how our service points are going to be distributed nationwide. For instance, we will not always set some of these up directly. We're going to be linked up with people like the post office and all the sort of stuff. Some of the mobile claim centers are going to go to even some of the rural areas. I think one of the things that we found with access is that if somebody is involved in an accident and they're in the rural areas, they really lost the transportation cost of going to a major city just to claim, denies them access. So some of them are going to be mobile the claim centers. But our processing is now going to be split into subdivisions. In the past, you used to have a claim handler who did everything. And that really was not providing benefit to the claimant. So we're going to have people who specialize in determining merit, who do medical, who do loss of earnings, and even those who deal with general damages. So we've got specialist units as opposed to generalist units. There's going to be benefits in terms of efficiencies. Our current staff complement is about 2,000. We think we can provide the same service with slightly less staff complement, but a more trained staff. Obviously, we're cognizant of the fact that, I think government does have, and in fact, our president has indicated that we should be growing jobs, and so we're not going to be reducing staff immediately. We're going to be looking at natural attrition and that sort of thing. But there will be service improvement. We've already gone live with SEP. SEP is one of the, global enterprise resource training solution. It allows us to be able to help to provide customer service better in the sense that it's fully integrated, and that's why it's called an enterprise-wide resource training solution. So if a client wants to know what's happening to that claim, they should be able to track every single place the claim is throughout the scheme. So some of these elements have already gone on, and we're actually creating a paperless environment in this regard. The claim solution is now going to be implemented beginning 5th of October. And, we actually scoured the whole world to look at the claim solution. If you really imagine what we want to do, we want to be able to go and almost operate like how private sector medical service providers operate. So well-operating medical schemes, what would happen is their card, an accident victim should be able to go to hospital, swipe their card, and know that they get the treatment they require. And then the hospital, who is the service provider, needs to know that they get paid immediately. I think one of the difficulties that we find, even with service providers, is that they also are unhappy about this gig. They're just a little unhappy. Ambulance groups, hospitals, including government-owned hospitals, are really not happy with the fall-based team because they are expected to go there and treat the accident victim immediately. That victim is lying there on the street. However, they're not assured of compensation from us. Firstly, they have to wait 5 years. 5 years. While we go and argue with the legal fraternity to determine who are at fault and determine quantum. And what it means for the business is that they're carrying a big debtor's book. And this is not only private sector hospital groups, even government hospitals. So this scheme also is having an impact on the healthcare sector, and that's why it needs to be changed. But one of the things we will do is ensure that we link directly with them and then be able to pay we pay them directly. And by the way, the new seniors claims administration solution is issued worldwide. See, one of the things we've said is accidents are a global problem. Every single country is dealing with it. So we shouldn't reinvent the wheel. And that's why we scoured the world. And you look at our sister companies in Australia, the TAC, or New Zealand, the ACC, have actually dealt with they adopted the same claims administration solution. So we're learning the same system that they're using. And by the way, in the US, Europe, and Canada, and that sort of thing, the scheme is used worldwide. So what we're going to be doing, though, is in reality, at the end of April, we're going to be cutting over completely to the new claims administration scheme. IT is a key component of this. We obviously wanted to start crawling before we start running and walking. So we had an approach where we said we'll stabilize, optimize, and innovate. And over a time period, stabilization we've achieved. So we get into a stage where we're optimizing and innovating. And we won't go through details of the roadmap. I'll take questions. But one of the things that we're creating is a very secure environment where everything is hosted to ensure that we eliminate fraud and we allow processing of claims as quickly as we can and to deter fraud. Okay? And just briefly, the second element of our rescue plan related to National Treasury setting up an appropriate fuel levy pricing model to allow the fuel levy to be set appropriately. I think I'm happy to say that this model was discussed with National Treasury and adopted last year, although it was not fully implemented. When we had the fuel levy increase last year, elements of the model were used. In the past, what used to happen is, in reality, it was nothing more than just what we call the thumbsuck. To say, like all the other fintechs, fuel levy will be classified with, levies such as, levies for people who are smoking and that sort of thing, and they do set at 5 cents. But what we're saying is, in reality, we have service providers. We have ambulance groups. We have hospitals that need to be compensated for the work that they're doing. And we went ahead and developed a model that allows National Treasury to determine the right amount of fuel levy. And just briefly, all that model is doing is a model used by regulators, like ICASA, NASA, and this sort of thing. And it's a model that says the industry has to be sustainable. You need ambulance groups to be profitable to be able to pick up people who are injured on the roads. You need hospitals to be able to pay their doctors for them to be able to participate in this sector. And as such, the role that we play in that regard is central. We need to ensure that we have appropriate capital, that there's a return on capital, and we build up a margin on that capital. And then as a fund, and by the way, we are also looked after by the Financial Services Board, we need to have the appropriate solvency ratios. If you look at how similar schemes like us have really dealt with this internationally, for instance, in New Zealand, the New Zealand government set up a target to say their scheme will be returned to profitability, will be fully capitalized by 2014. So they recognize the fact that it may take a little while to set up the field levy in a manner that allows it to be fully capitalized by a certain time. The Australian scheme used to be exactly the same as us at the TAC. They've also took a couple of years to reach this stage. But with this model, it will allow us to do that. I won't go into detail on it, only to say that the model allows government to go set up a field levy to deal with the backlog of claims. At the moment, we're not able to pay all claims because we don't have sufficient funds to deal with the backlog. But it also allows us to take care of future claims and then build up capital base. And the way it builds up, it looks at the cost, as in all the expenses, the cost of paying the claim, as in the expenses, a sustainability margin, and the return on capital. And then using all sorts of economic data, fuel sales, inflation and that sort of thing, because if you think about it, loss of income is determined by income levels throughout the country, how they grow and that sort of thing. There's a lot of economic data that go into this, that, you know, a stochastic model uses it and it simulates a distribution that allows us to set the right amount of field levy. So it may be technical, but we won't go through this in detail. For instance, about 2 years ago, we actually had determined that we would need about 57 cents a litre in fuel levy just to look at future claims. But in addition to that, we needed a different figure to look at current claims, which was around 40 cents a litre and that sort of thing. So the model is there. It's used by National Treasury. We're hoping that they continue to use it. The key, though, is on the slide 79. It gives National Treasury flexibility to determine a policy. They can go and set up a flat yield levy to look at the backlog. Remember, one of the problems that we have is that somebody will have to pay for the problems that we have. If you're sitting with a $40 billion deficit, someone does need to pay for it. You can either leave it to future generations or we can deal with it now. But it allows us to either set a flat levy or cash injection and that sort of thing. So the model is flexible enough to allow us to do so. So I won't go through the model in detail. And just a final aspects of how we're doing. Just financial performance up to March 2009. We've operated, obviously, in challenging economic conditions in the sense that, the country went into recession and that sort of thing. And these are the projections of what might happen into the future. At the time that we finalizing the results, those were some of the forecast economic growth and declines for those years. We won't focus too much on those. But most of our income derives from fuel that is sold throughout the country. We've experienced a major decline from 25,000 megalitres to about 18,000 megalitres in fuel in the past financial year. So that would have had an impact on our income. And obviously vehicle sales have also declined, although, the expectation is that it may increase a little bit, but it declined in the past financial year. But despite all of it, if you look at where the backlog was of outstanding claims, say in 2006, it was sitting at 443 outstanding claims. At the end of the financial year, we're sitting with 297. So despite the fact that we did not have sufficient cash, we've been able to reduce the backlog of outstanding claims significantly. But not only have we reduced it by this amount, we've reduced it in an environment where claims lodged was increasing. You know, you look at data and you look at our sister companies saying, as an example, that deaths in the roads have stabilized or declined. We actually haven't experienced it. We actually, over the last couple of years, we've been experiencing an increase in claims lodged with us that has been growing at exponentially. You look at 2006, we had planes lost with us at 190,468, and last year we received 294,000 claims as the Rotex Fund. And but this shows why data is important. And I think one of the things that we do require, for instance, is this RCMC to not only focus on people who die, but to also focus on people who are injured. That the WHO World Health Organization report indicates that there's a factor of 1 to 20 number of fatalities on the roads to number of people who are injured. And in fact, what costs you more is the people who are injured on the road. And unless we measure it and we monitor how that improves over time, we will always wonder why organizations like the RAF keep experiencing increasing claims, even in an environment where fatalities may be stabilizing or reducing. So just to reduce the backlog, we've had to actually process much more volume of claims. I mean, last year we processed 330,000 claims. So you'll see that we experienced quite a lot of efficiencies in the way we're doing. And this is even before we implemented the new claim system. We actually think that we can get rid of the backlog much quicker if we, you know, as soon as we've implemented the new claims, assuming that money doesn't become a problem. So we have made inroads on the backlog. I mean, we ran out of money last year, and in fact, there were 4 or 5 months where we didn't process claims. And that's when we came to government and we're given 2.5 billion rand. But we still were able to catch up. But the other important thing is that the average age of the claim is getting young, which means that although you see the backlog at 300,000 claims, it's actually made up of newer claims as opposed to older claims. So we have now 50% of all the claims that are in the backlog that are younger than a year, which actually shows that there is some improvement that we're making. The provision for outstanding claims is still a black box, and we'll deal with it in a little while. You know, it's one area where the actuaries, by the way, annually what actuaries do is they look at two things. They look at the number of accidents that have occurred in the country and the number of claims that we have in the system, and they determine how much our potential liability is going to be. At the moment, they're saying that liability is going to be 42 billion rand. They're saying we need 42 billion rand to go and pay not only for claims that are in the system, but only claims arising out of accidents that have occurred that have not been reported to us. And that figure has been rising. In fact, this year alone, I mean, the increase in the provision was 12 billion because we were sitting with 30 billion last year. It's in an area that requires attention. And we'll come to the slides on here, but if you look at the income we received last year, we received 8.8 billion in fuel levy income last year. We received 2.5 billion last year around November, December as additional allocations from government. So in total, our income was 11.9 billion. We paid most of it in claims that we paid in cash, 11.1 billion. We paid in cash. And, you know, and we looked at some of the graphs. Our expenditure has really been in line with what we expected. And by the way, the additional 500 million income, the reason it's increased by that much is that we do engage in reinsurance activities. So when we paid Shosh last year, part of the amount that was paid by the reinsurer in London. One of the things they said is they're not quite happy with the risk that they find in the South African scheme. And our premiums, not only are they going up, they're not interested in the risk anymore. So, I mean, they just don't believe that you can have a claim that high, especially in a developing economy. But that's where some of the income comes from. But we'll see it later in the slide. But we actually still insolvent. We'll look at it pictorially. But if you look at the balance sheet, the RAF owns very little assets. In our current assets, you'll see that the billion rand in cash, this is equivalent to just 1 month's worth of claims, because we pay a billion rand a month in claims. Income receivable is what receivable revenue SARS owes us in fuel levy that they've collected that they haven't paid to us. But in reality, we only have 158 million rand worth of property, just the building ahead of this that we have. But if you look at our liabilities, we've got a provision. The biggest liability is obviously a provision for accidents that are for care that we need to pay for. According to this, 9 billion is in current and 33 billion is in non-current liabilities. So that's where the 42 billion comes in. And when we're saying we're insolvent, it's because of two reasons. Whenever your assets at 3.2 billion are less than what you owe other people at 43 billion, you're insolvent. Technically, even if you close shop tomorrow, there wouldn't be sufficient money to pay for all the people who who have lodged claims, who've been involved in accidents. And it's a problem then that needs to be resolved, partly through the implementation of the funding model and that sort of thing. And just pictorially, briefly, although we've experienced increases in income, it's only because we received the extra 2.5 billion allocation from, from government last year when we ran out of cash. And by the way, as a road accident fund, we do have an element of protection. We can go out and use a section called Section 21 of the Act, where we say to accident victims and say, sorry, we are unable to pay, and therefore claim from the wrongdoer. Now, implementing Section 21 would probably be unfair to the motoring public, because not only would be unexpected, and people would not have arranged their affairs appropriately for that, it just shifts the burden onto other sectors of society, like the healthcare and that sort of thing. And that's why we haven't really implemented it. But that's the growth in our revenue. And by the way, it's 64 cents a litre. This fuel levy is tiny compared to, I think, the rest of the prices of fuel. Obviously, the prices of fuel goes up and down depending on what's happening in the world market. It's less than 7%. And unfortunately, our fuel is still classified in the same manner as other taxes on fuel. I mean, there's the custom and excise tax, the slate tax, and wholesale margins, and those sort of stuff. And we are classified, our real levy is classified as part of those taxes. We actually believe that we should not be a tax, because this is a premium that is paid by South Africans for cover. And then it should be calculated independently of normal taxes. And the reason for this is that you cannot go and say, I've only collected a billion rand of taxes, and therefore don't get involved in accidents that exceed that amount. And so it doesn't happen that way. If somebody has been involved in an accident, we have to pay, irrespective of whether you've collected a certain amount of taxes or not. And over the years, what's been happening is that because we haven't been collecting sufficient taxes, this liability just kept on growing. And that's one of the difficulties that we've had. So that's the makeup of our income, 2.5 billion in additional grants from government. And we don't want this additional handout. As a road accident fund, we would prefer for the revenue requirement model to be used to determine the right amount of fuel levy, in the sense that we do not have to come to National Treasury and keep asking for additional money. Because this is the second time in the last, say, 3 years, 3 to 4 years, that we've actually had an additional emergency allocation of 2.5 billion. And we don't want this. We prefer for the model to be used to determine the right amount of fuel levy so that we don't come and ask for more money. Diesel refund, as I said, is now 870 million this year. It's been growing significantly from 400 million in 2005 to 800 million. Claims payments are still by far the biggest amount of cost, the 23 billion. This includes the provision, but if you exclude the provision for outstanding claims, we have paid in cash 11.3 billion in 2009 compared to 8.7 billion last year. So it's a phenomenal growth in payment. We actually have an ability to pay anything between 1 and 1.5 billion per month. It's just that we just don't have sufficient cash to do so. The interesting thing, though, is those claimants who do take advantage of claiming directly from the road accident fund have been experiencing really a significant decline in the backlog. So a lot of hospital groups, because they are business people and they do understand that it's easier to not engage in litigious, long-winded processes to claim from us. And some of them voluntarily have said, we'd like to claim directly from you. You'll see that the backlog has dropped from 100,000 in 2005 to only 23,000 this year. So claiming directly from the RBA can improve the time it takes. Can improve the time it takes to claim, to get your claim processed, and it reduces the cost involved in the processing because there's fewer legal costs and this sort of thing. So we find hospital groups, ambulance groups, the net 1091s and this sort of thing prefer this. And lots of government hospitals prefer to claim directly from us now. And unfortunately, the one area where we had legal challenges has been what we call non-supplier claims. We're talking only South Africans are still not able to we haven't been able to pay them directly, and that's why the backlog has been slower in reducing. But some of these slides are key. Of the 11 billion that we paid, we have spent last year 2.5 billion rand in legal costs. Every single year to be paying 2 billion rand a year. That money could build houses, could build hospitals, could fix the roads that motorists are traveling on. To be spending 2 billion just in determining who's at fault, but also in going and saying how much should we pay you, this subjective amount of quantum is really, really wasteful. And all we need is a scheme where you go and introduce a no-fault scheme where you don't need to go and do those exercises. Suddenly you have 2.5 billion each year available that should go to accident victims and claimants and even other areas in society, like, you know, fixing trauma units in hospitals and that sort of thing. This is exceptionally wasteful. It's a drain on the scheme. But I think it gets worse. You'll see that this slide I've actually updated compared to the one that you had in there. And I'll tell you why I've updated it. This one relates to contingency fees. This is one area, again, where we think that accident victims are truly taken for a ride. You know, if you really think about what we're supposed to do as a road accident fund, if we go to someone who's been involved in an accident and we say, you have spent 1,000 rand in medical costs, we want to go and give you back the 1,000 rand so that you can defray your medical costs, so that you can pay your hospital bills. We don't pay you more or less. We pay you exactly how much it costs you in medical costs. To have the legal fraternity going and taking a success fee of as much as 50% of that amount, that means you have to find the money somewhere. And the poor are the ones who suffer the most. The poor are the ones who suffer the most because really this is not fair. And it actually gets worse because if you look at the previous slide, we are paying out of the 2.5 billion in legal costs. Where's my previous slide? We also pay the plaintiff attorney. So what the scheme has been saying to only South Africans is, listen, this scheme is based on the law. You can claim from the RAF. The RAF will pay your legal costs to enable you to claim. And those legal costs, I mean, we pay them at part and party rate, which is actually determined not by the road accident fund. But to go on top of that and say, no, in addition to that, we need success fee. Really, it's not fair on South Africans. And if you estimate that because the legal fraternity refuses to use the Statutory Contingency Fee Act. The Statutory Contingency Fee Act, in effect, what it says is this, is that you could charge contingency fee at not party and party costs, at clients and attorney fees, up to a maximum of 25%. But the legal fraternity does not use it. The reason we know they don't use it is that they are, if you do use the Statutory Contingency Fee Act, you're supposed to lodge that agreement in court or, you know, or at least with us when the matter is settled. And we have not seen a single one that is lodged in court. So what the legal fraternity is using is a common law contingency fee. And because it is not known to us, it's hidden to us, you know, they could be charging as much as 50%. Now, if you think about the money that really reaches accident victims, to think that close to close to 6.8 billion rand that should be reaching accident victims does not reach those accident victims. That really is sad. In fact, contingency fees should not apply in compensatory schemes like us, especially where we do pay legal fees. It is a problem. And by the way, another difficulty though is that to use, I think, society's ignorance, and ignorance would even apply to qualified people like myself who may be a CA, who may not know the Third Party Compensation Act, because you're ignorant of the law. For somebody to come to you and say, you know, there is a risk that you may not be paid by the REF, therefore sign two things, a power of attorney, where we deal with the Rotary Fund directly, number one, and then on top of that, you sign all these contingency fee agreements. It becomes, South Africans actually don't know that what they're getting is not what they pay. Often what happens, though, is those few claimants who, either by luck, contact us, only just to find out how much we paid, are the ones who eventually know that we may have paid 50,000 and the attorney has given them 1,000 or 2,000 rand. But the reason the public is not complaining is actually they don't know and the information is kept away from them. One of the things that we've been fighting for, even when we look at the direct payment system, was to say we don't want to interfere with your client attorney relationship. All we want is transparency. We want an accident victim to know that the REF today has settled and paid, say, 50,000 rand, so that when you go and pay 25,000 rand of it to your attorney, at least you do it with your eyes open. But that fact has been fought, and, you know, tooth and nail by the Law Society. And I think it's one area where I think transparency is required. It's one area where South Africans are really victimized. And just one other thing to also indicate about the Law Society is that most of the money that we pay goes into trust accounts. And in fact, when we said we paid 11 billion, because most of the money goes through the attorney's bank accounts, the interest on those trust accounts funds the Law Society. And you can see why they are fighting us tooth and nail to keep the scheme where it is. There's a huge financial gain in this regard. So we do have difficulty. I guess the real problem, though, is SRES, what we want is a very simple scheme. We want a scheme where we can go out and say to accident victim, and you'll see now when I look at the makeup of the damages, where most of the money should reach accident victims. And in this case, it's not reaching them, and it is sad. And this is actually the slide that indicates why this scheme does not meet its social objective. Remember what we said, the real social objective of the scheme is it's a scheme that's based on injury, meaning that if you're involved in a road accident, you break your leg, we should be paying for your medical costs. But if you look at how much we paid for medical costs, remember we paid 11 billion. We only paid 847 million rand. 800 million out of 11 billion in genuine medical costs. I mean, that really is fair, because that means that the scheme is not paying for what its real intended purposes are, because it's supposed to pay for people who are injured. But look at all the amounts of money that we pay. We pay 4.9 billion, just close to 5 billion in general damages. That, again, is exceptionally wasteful. It's a leaklet in the scheme. What this says is that somebody goes to a doctor after having a tiny little bumper fishing accident, and they pay for one consultation. Consultation could be 200 rand or 75 rand or whatever the case is. That's all they need. And once they say so, and the doctor says, your neck is sore, and the doctor says, but I can't see, but I can't say your neck is not sore. You know, it's whiplash. And therefore, if you tell me your neck is sore, yes, your neck is sore. And they write a report. And then they use that to come and claim from us, and we pay general damages. So the proportion of payments we're making for injuries to payments we make for general damages is really exceptionally skewed. And that's why in the Amendment Act, we've been trying to say there are people out there who are genuinely injured. There are paraplegics and those sort of things, people in wheelchair. Perhaps we should limit this 4.9 billion people who are seriously injured. But in reality, at the moment, this scheme is abused exceptionally. We cannot be paying 800 million and 5 billion in general damages. And in fact, if you compare the 800 million to the 2.5 billion we're paying in legal fees, really, this is exceptionally disproportionate. And it represents a big leakage in the scheme. And remember, it just takes a few plugging of the holes that suddenly makes 5 billion cash available for accident victims, 2.5 billion cash available from legal fees. And suddenly, out of 11 billion, you're looking at 7 billion that you can go and help accident victims and build trauma units and that sort of thing. So there is big leakage in the scheme. So this is just percentage-wise. The scheme is still, really a wasteful scheme. We grossly undercapitalized the suspect, and by the way, the undercapitalization has spent over a number of years. The gap has been increasing, and this is only because the fuel levy, there's been a disconnect in the manner in which you set the fuel levy in relation to looking after the backlog. And ever so often when you run out of cash, it's because we are also illiquid. And our cash holding just represents one month's worth of claims at a billion rand. And just on the outstanding liability, just the purple elements of the slide, when actuaries look at valuing our liability, they look at accidents that have happened, that haven't been reported to us. This is what is called IBNR, incurred but not reported claims. And they do take that into account when they look at our outstanding liability. And we won't go through it in detail. I think the important thing, though, is most of the liability obviously arose out of recent years. There's been a real big upset in the number of claims that have been reported to us. And on a present value basis, it's 42 billion. In nominal terms, the amount is a little higher. And again, even this liability that is sitting in our books, this big hole, if you got rid of general damages, for instance, and legal costs, shoot, you've already taken over 60% of this outstanding liability. In fact, both claimants' legal costs and our own legal costs, you're taking care of, just under 80% of your outstanding liability. So there's a few things that can be done to really address some of the problems in the robotics and funding the scheme. It does require, I think, this committee, Department of Transport, to take the bold steps. And just finally, just on the small aspects, a staff complement is still, I think, representative of demographics of society. You look at the blue is the proportions of African colored Indians, whites, and gender, we actually have more females than males, and expenses are in line. The only thing I want to say in terms of the budget that is in the MTEF process is that it doesn't allow us sufficient cash to process claims, and by that I say this, is that you will see though that our field levy income is not going to grow by much. We're sitting at 64 cents. Our indications are that if we get only 5 cents a litre, which is what National Treasury has said, if they don't use the model, then our backlog will go backwards. So we will actually, not experience. We will not actually make inroads in processing of claims. You'll see that we will pay, last year we paid 11.3 billion. We can only pay 11.8 billion in claims in the new year if we only get a 5 cents a litre increase. And things will just get tighter, from then onwards. And their spending liability, the deficit will continue to grow unless we change the scheme. So, Madam Chair, I think with just those few slides, I'm hoping that that's beginning to give an indication of who we are, some of our challenges, the wastefulness in our scheme, and hopefully as we engage in the future, we'll be coming up with solutions to some of these problems. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very well-detailed presentation. That has got a document also that what is being presented on the screen is also what we have, which is good, because sometimes we would be presented with something different. A hard copy would be different from what is on the screen, and as a result, we'd find it difficult to follow and also make comments as you present. I will now open for questions and comments. Honorable Faro, followed by Honorable Dupusa, and then Honorable Mzile Lucas.
First of all, let me thank Mr. Madisi for his presentation. As you said, it was always professional and thorough. My concern, though, having been here before, is that we seem to be hearing the same old story. I would like to have thought that this portfolio committee, and I said it once before, has the power to change things for you, to make things work for you. We actually had Treasury here last year to try and remodel the whole aspect of the fuel levy to ensure that the money you get is not going to, as you say, at 5 cents per litre, actually not make any dent in the backlog, which we're all concerned about, and that the deficit will continue to grow, so your insolvency levels are going one way. Now, we need to take the bull by the horn, I think, Madam Chair. We have a scheme here that is, as the CEO said, is relied upon by many, many people. We actually did some amendments in 4 years ago, which said, let's get a situation whereby if foreign claims are going to take place in this country, they are not paid out in dollars and pounds, etc. They are paid out in the currency of our country, and in accordance with the tariffs of our doctors and hospitals. I mean, that's the first thing I think that we need to get straight here. There is nowhere else in the world, and I think the CEO was right in saying that, where we accept people into this country on the basis that they can land here, put 20 rand worth of diesel or whatever, petrol, into a motorbike, and have an accident and claim 500 million. Now, that has got to be put an end to. And the power rests in ourselves to make sure that that actually happens. And it does not ever occur again. Because when we go overseas, we actually take out medical insurance or covering or anything like that. So I just want to find out the status of that whole deliberation that we had. And I'm glad that Dr. Kurtz is here, because the problem was, after passing all that and putting the caps into place, the 160,000 rand, we are are no better off, in effect, if you look at these particular figures we presented today, than we were 4 years ago. Now, when the CEO reported to us last time, he indicated to us that there were various constitutional challenges that were taking place within the terminology of identifying, for instance, the issue of serious injury. And at the same time, there were some changes that were made by the department before that amendment went through for final ratification, or whatever you like to call it, ascension, I think the word is the correct word. And needless to say, it delayed the process, which resulted in us having to go back to the president. And I think the CEO said to me, and Jacob, you must confirm this, I made a mental note of it, that it was costing you as the RAF $10 million a day. $10 million a day. Purely because the amendment never went through that this parliament actually asked to go through in the right way. Now, that worries me. You know, and we are still today sitting trying to get this thing into place. We've had Treasury here. Treasury have said they will relook at the model. I mean, surely the cheapest form of providing some insurance to people is going to have to be through the fuel levy. It's a user pay principle, everybody's part of it. Therefore, if it requires that we have to go and appeal for an increase in that levy to be able to accommodate you, to ensure that you're not going to go backwards and the backlog is going to actually reduce, then I think we need to do that too. Now, I just want to touch on the whole question of litigation. It's been an old hobby horse of mine, and I'll say it, and I'll say it once. The trouble with the RAF, Jacob, is that you have something like, I don't know, outside of the Department of Justice, something like about 500-600 attorneys in your business. Now, what does that tell you? Immediately that you have litigators inside your business instead of administrators, there's going to be a challenge somewhere with another lawyer who's just waiting for these books open to write checks out and to make sure that someone is going to be right and someone is going to be wrong. And 90% of the claims that are actually made are through people fighting each other over litigation matters, and they usually get settled on the stairs or the steps of the court before you even go into the thing. Now, in the Western Cape here, 5 years ago, there was an arbitration pilot project that was set into being. What this did, Madam Chair, was to say, let's take these two parties that are fighting each other with their lawyers, with high risk and high cost, and put them into front of each other and arbitrate, and say, let's settle. Let's rather than go to court and cost this extraordinary amount of money, which you see reflected in the CEO's report here, get it out of the way. And we administrate this claim as like any other person would do it on the basis of fair compensation, etc. I just think that we need to know whether that arbitration process is not the way forward to get rid of this horrible amount that you talk about of 2.15 billion, which shatters us. It's actually, it's like putting money into a bottomless pit, because you got 2.5 billion from us last year as an special cash injection. And all it did was cover the damn cost of another couple of lawyers having a go at each other. And I want to just ask another thing of the CEO, Chair, and that is that if he is aware of any legal processes that are not above board, has the RAF taken it upon themselves to go and report those particular lawyers who are unscrupulous to the Law Society and put it on the table and ask them to investigate it? And I'd like to know whether that is in fact happening, because not all of them are like that. There are certain people that are doing it unscrupulously, and we need to get on top of that as part of the process. I will leave it there, Madam Chair. I've said quite a lot, but I want to come back, please, if I can, before 12:30, because I have to go to an appointment.
Thank you,
Madam
Chair. I was very glad to see, first of all, thank you to Mr. Mazzisi for a very detailed, very good presentation. I was very glad to see that he had put in statistics here. And in fact, already it appears these statistics are outdated, because the early the road safety conference that the minister attended earlier this year in Dar es Salaam indicates that in Africa, everybody from the age of about 10 onwards, if the trends continue as is, in about 15 years' time, road deaths will be the number one killer of all age groups. From about the age of 10 up, and that will surpass HIV and all sorts of other dreaded diseases. And that if it continues this trend. And the we're the biggest road killer on the planet. We kill about 200 million people a year. Am I getting my numbers right? 200,000 people a year. And it's just, the trend is just continuing. So it's just madness. So I'm glad he's put these things in, because it's just, particularly in South Africa, it just seems to be sort of underrated. And we need to, I know it's not the RAF's problem, we need to address the department in this regard. What I wanted to first of all, just for the RAF's information, I'm one of those 297,000 claims. I was in a car accident and I was in a wheelchair for a year and all sorts of things. So I'm also on the receiving end. And I must tell you, it's very good news of what you're giving us, of all the changes that you're anticipating for appearing. Just from a personal experience, before I had to basically forced to go to for legal assistance, was my dealings with the RAF were less than satisfactory, and that's being very kind. And so as a road victim, one is forced to go and seek legal advice, because they're the ones who know who to talk to and how to do things and so forth. And my accident was in 2007, and my court case is only next year, at least scheduled for next year. It's absolute madness, and the psychological things that comes out of that, I'm not even talking about the accident that goes with it, and the drama that one has to experience with the RAF is just traumatic. So I mean, I think these changes are important, and these kind of things need to be taken into account, because as things stand, it appears that I will go to court, and just the whole thing is just very traumatic. So I want to just echo what my colleague said. I think we need to look at what changes can we push through right now, and what is that, and again, I'm a new member, so I'd like to find out what is the holdup, you know, that these changes are happening. What can we do to speed through, and quite frankly, bulldoze this parliament if we have to, because it's costing this parliament, this country, this economy, billions of rands, and these changes need to happen. And if we need to start the process and somehow have to talk to whoever we have to, what can we do that will speed things up? And secondly, what is the hold-up? I'd be interested. I'm sure it's a very basic answer. But what's been the hold-up so far? The other thing is that in these changes, the only comment really that I want to make is that the changes that you're making that are very exciting and appear to be very good is to try and make, again from my personal experience, the RAF more user-friendly and more efficient. Because that was overwhelmingly what came across to me. It was just inefficient and just bloated, and it's another government department that's inefficient, doesn't work, and it's just slow and so forth. And if we were to talk to the legal fraternity, I'm sure that would be one of the arguments. It's people need their assistance because of this. So it needs to be free, user-friendly, easy, approachable, so that it doesn't have to be complicated and over the top to get to the RAF and just deal with a case. Sure, there are lots of shysters out there, a lot of people who are trying to buck the system and trying to get a quick buck. But in my case, where it's not just a muscle that's sore, it's physical bones that have been shattered and all sorts of things, it's all very clear and straightforward, and yet, despite all this, it's going to be very complicated and arguing and, you know, all sorts of things. It's just very, very difficult. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me join my colleagues by commending the minister for the detailed and informative presentation. While we're making the presentation, we touch on a very sensitive issue, the issue of the attorneys, which are getting between 25% to 50% of the money that is supposed to go to the victims. But you know, as members of parliament, we've got constituency offices. And when most of the citizens are being affected, they go to those offices to seek some assistance or whatever. When you touch the road accident office to find out really what is the total amount that has been received by that particular victim, they will refer you to the attorney. I've experienced it several times, whereby they said, no, we've done with that particular issue, so can you check with the attorney? money on monthly basis, maybe 500 rand per month, but you don't know exactly how much did the road accident fund compensated you. Then the other thing is that you've touched on the interest, you know, someone holding your money, then investing it, but you don't know what happened with the interest of that particular money. While on the other side, you don't know how much they have obtained from the road accident fund, which is a very sensitive and thorny issue. Then secondly, what I just wanted to find out, how long does this process, the claiming process, take? If maybe everything goes according to the plan, how long does it take? And also, can we get an indication, really, the direct payment to beneficiaries? Because while I was thinking of this, I was just thinking, I'm not sure whether it's 1% of the victims who are directly paid, because most of the people, they go via these attorneys. Are there any public outreach programs that are being conducted by the Road Accident Fund, just to empower people on how to, what is the role of the accident fund, if they're involved in the accident, what processes or procedure to follow. Then moreover, I was just thinking about your form. Is your form, your claim form, user friendly? Because if even myself as a member of parliament, I can't fill that particular form. What about the ordinary citizen in Buzini who is illiterate? Then that person has no other option except the option of going via to the lawyer. All those things are the things that maybe at the end of the day lead us to spend more on legal, on this legal cost and other things, because people are not aware what procedures to follow. The form itself is not user-friendly. The language, because each and every time we're talking of these forms in English, Afrikaans, whatever, there's no Siswati form, there's no Zulu form to assist a person on the standard 2, on the standard 5, according to the cell in. They look from the Labantuan, I'm legally called that particular form. While I was reading your report, you experienced the challenge of not paying the service provider on time. What is the current situation? Because if service providers are not paid on time, especially maybe the medical, whatsoever emergency and medical providers, it means that our services are being affected thereof. Then the other thing that I wanted to know, since we have changed from, you indicated that initially the levy was collected by the central energy, then there was this shift to SARS. Can you share us the success stories and the challenges that you are experiencing as the raft, as raft, since there was that shift from the collection of levy? Then the other one, I think is the last one, can I be clarified on this funeral cost? Is it paid on the flat rate? Because while I was looking at the slide, they are spending the lowest amount, 26 million, if I'm not mistaken, on the funeral cost. How is it paid? Is it a flat rate or is there's a certain formula that you are using to pay that one? Then the last one, I think it has been touched by Honorable Farrell. I was just worried about this compensation to foreign visitors. If there's no limit, there's no guideline, we're just paying in dollars, pounds, and euros. That is why at the end of the day is paid half a million to one victim, while on the other side, funding is a problem to cover other services that you're supposed to do. Then it means that at the end of the day, have problems. Thank you, Chairperson. Oh, the last one, the issue of the board. I was just looking at your previous report that the term of the board was expiring in July 2009. Do we have a new board in place? What is the situation? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's all. good presentation. I said, one of the things is that if we travel overseas, first of all, we have to make sure we have extra cover. And why don't we implement a system in the same way that when people from out of the country come here, they must make sure. If they don't have it, because if I get ill in Paris or so, I've got to find the money to cover that bill. So I think they're really ripping us off. The other thing is that I'm so happy that we talk about the RAF, because that's been a thorn in the flesh for many, many years, and it's been abused by many people. 2 years ago, I was at the hospital in Durban with a friend of mine, and there were angels running around to the people. What is it, accident here? And, oh no, then it goes on and getting people to sign in the reception room. And I thought this was very, very unkind. And you get to people when you're vulnerable, you've just come out of accident, you can't think properly, and you sign. So then you go. The legal people, yes, they serve a purpose, but I don't think it should be their main source of income, because this is what they've made a livelihood out of this year. They do everything, and all they're going to do is go. And worst of all, the victim never knows how much they're entitled to. The other issue is this: in the rural areas, we have a lot of accidents with tractors and trailers without lights, and then it's also said that the diesel, there's a rebate. Now, it seems to be contradictory, because the same vehicle which is not supposed to be licensed is on the road, and it's caused an accident, and now no one can claim from them. So we should look at that very closely and say, well, now, guys, your tractor's caught on the road, what is it? Because someone has to pay. And the vehicles which are unroadworthy, that unroadworthiness, there's speeding, and there's alcohol. So I'm saying, if I've committed this thing, I should pay, because I'm the cause of the problem. Now, you can't depend on the RAF. So most of the money which is supposed to be saved, the bloke has committed the crime, he's been under the influence, or he's speeding, he gets away scot-free. That's not even in question. So I think we need to look at this. May I just ask a question? Is paraffin also on the levy? Oh, well, I was a bit concerned about that, because if there was levy on paraffin, because the people that we're talking about who claim that some of them directly or indirectly pay, because when you pay your taxi fee or your traveling fee, you are paying towards this, the fund. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think I'd like to thank committee members for the insightful questions they've asked. Perhaps dealing with them as they arose. I do agree, Honourable Farrer, that it sounds like a broken record, because these issues have been with us for this long. And in fact, it goes back to what I had said earlier, that we've had 7 commissions of inquiry, and progress seems to be slow. Just dealing with some of them individually, National Treasury attempted to use the model last year. When we got 17.5 cents a litre, we had said to them that 5 cents is not the right level, that we use the model. I think one of the difficulties that they had when we engaged with them was that they were saying they're trying to balance the impact on the economy because of the timing and all the sort of stuff. So in reality, the 17.5 cents was not what the model predicted the fuel levy should have gone up by. So it was less than what the model required. And we're hoping that, you know, that we actually don't look at fuel levy on as it relates to RAF as a tax, that in fact we look at it as I think as part of a model for funding as the cause of road accidents in society. The problem with not doing it correctly is that we're shifting the responsibility to our future generations. And this is what is wrong. It's all very well not setting the right bill levy. Somebody will pay. And those people who will pay are, you know, I think our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. And to be shifting the problem all the time to future generations is also not appropriate. So we continue to engage with them as it relates to that. I'll let the status of the amendment, I think DOT, I'll ask them to deal with it. But just on litigation, as it relates to, again, to the Road Accident Fund, I agree with you, we have quite a lot of staff members in the fund that are legally qualified and that. One of the slides that I didn't show, which is, I think, one of my better slides, is in the intervention that we're doing, is we're actually retraining every single one of our staff members. We are finding that if we start having a scheme where we specialize, where a lawyer doesn't have to be a medical expert. You'll be amazed in the RAF that our lawyers talk about Lascaux coma scale and Jesus, complex medical terms, which they're not even qualified to do. That in fact, we're going to find over time that we're going to be reskilling, we're going to be employing people who are skilled in their specialist unit, rather than have a jack of all trades doing that. That in fact, from next year onwards, is an area that we're going to be concentrating on. So, there will be, although there's maybe a net reduction, some of it will result in new skills. And but it's true that most of the claims are settled at the steps of the court. The one difficulty that we have, and I know you mentioned the accreditation pilot project, and you're asking what's happening to it. Just two things. The pilot project was run in Cape Town. The objectives of the project, it was supposed to achieve two objectives. The first one was to reduce the time it takes to settle the claim and also to reduce the cost. So those were measurable objectives that we were using to determine the success or failure of the pilot project. So what we were hoping would happen is that if it took 18 months to get a court date, or it took, so much longer to do that, that in fact this process could be shortened through the conciliation and other processes around the arbitration. It's sad to note, though, that what we found is the behaviors that already existed in the current scheme continued, in the sense that most of the I think both our panel members and our plaintiff attorneys waited, for example, for a date to be set by the arbitration forum before they started doing work. So in reality, all the dates they continue to sit while accident victims do not get compensation and only start doing work 10 days before the court date and that sort of thing. So we haven't been able to break those behaviors. So they continued. So it didn't even save time. As an example, for instance, the Shosh claim was also one of the claims, that 500 billion claim was also one of the claims that were in the pilot project. The claim, the accident happened in 2002. And that claim was only settled, even after intervention and that sort of thing, in 2007, 2008. So again, it's taken 5 years to settle the claim, even when the claim was in the arbitration forum. And when we look at it, is what we found, though, is the same behavior that persisted before just continued. And, it takes two to tango, and I think elements of it arises out of our own plaintiff attorneys who are saying they're not going to do any work, well, from the REF itself, that work is not done until there is pressure of time. and you wait for documents to be submitted, and you also wait for the plaintiff to do all the work before you do the claim. I think what you said, though, is we haven't used some of the elements in our legislation that forces us, for instance, to get the claimant to subject themselves to medical tests. So what we're saying is, oh, we haven't had a medical legal report, so we don't know how to assess the claim, and we wait. As opposed to saying, Mr. Shosh, please come to this doctor so that we can get a report to make an assessment. So it's been partly, I think, our fault. The behavior has continued. But cost, it didn't cost us any cheaper, especially if we take time into account. Obviously, if matters go through normal court, we don't pay for the judges and that sort of thing. But in arbitration, the RAF was paying for obviously the arbitrator and all the costs. And we found cost-wise that we're not getting the benefit. The real problem, though, is behavior that has been ingrained over 60-odd years that has been difficult to break. And sadly, there's been the failure in the arbitration project. What we have said, though, is arbitration per se is still a sort of a dispute resolution mechanism of choice. Perhaps the difficulty was the manner in which we set it up. Because if you look at other jurisdictions, for instance, in Australia and in countries like that, they have arrangements. They call them protocols that they have with bodies, attorney bodies, where they agree on not only cost, speed in which people respond, and that sort of thing. I think with regard to South Africa, the relationship has been just exceptionally adversarial, that as opposed to being cooperative, we actually sought to fight one another. And that's I think, the sad part with the arbitration forum, because I think it could have worked. It's perhaps the manner in which it was implemented and that sort of thing. Are we aware of legal processes that are not above board, and do we report them to the Law Society? In fact, we have a forensic unit where we work on with...
Interrupt you, Mr. Sorry, I asked the chair before she left, just for a follow-up on that thing, because I think it's the most important thing we can possibly put on the table today because of the legal costs and the implications. One of the things which you mentioned, which highlighted that protocol issue.
Yeah.
I mean, if we look at court precedent over the last 60 years, you refer to the 60 years, I promise you there is precedent for every injury and case claim that has taken place within the RAF over that period. Now, if those arbitrators, let's call them that, are given a fixed rate to go out there and to make a deal with Lindsay, let's take it, as a legal person within your organization, who I hope and that you would be training in a sense of an administrative mandate to go there and say, look, this is a, you know, there's a horrible word they use called the meat list, which is generally known amongst all personnel claim consultants in the world, not even here, but in the world, where you know if you break an arm, it's 250 rand. If you break a leg, now, we are spending the billions, 2.15 billion, Madam Chair, on legal fees, when in fact we could actually get two of these legal-minded people together with a protocol, as you say, to determine the value of that claim based on precedent. If there's a reduction of that precedent, well, all very well, that's even better for us. But, I mean, surely these things can be speeded up to get rid of the backlog, and there we have the answer.
Yeah, and just to you, Madam Chair, I think that point is accepted. And for us, nothing would have been better than to be able to deal with it on that basis. I think one of the difficulties we found is that unless we also address some of the perverse incentives that are operating in here, you know, we probably, some of these other interventions never work. And some of these perverse incentives clearly arises out of, from, say, the plaintiff's point of view, the hope that they can get more and more and more. Remember, they get 50% of compensation. So the more you get, you know, the more you hold out for. And, you know, and that's why you settle at the steps of the court, because what you're saying is, you know, I'm really not at risk because the RAF is paying for my legal costs. But, you know, hey, you know, this compensation, there's now suddenly have been a 500 billion rand claim. Jesus, That means if the cost originally has settled somebody at 1 million, 2 million, Jesus, maybe I can get away with 50 million. And that stops people from settling. And again, I want to reemphasize that most of the discussions in court is in fact not around fault. Most of the debates and fights in the legal system is not around who caused the accident. It's actually around quantum, because it's so subjective. Because it's like you can throw a, you know, a dart at the wall, and you're lucky, and the guy just push and push and push. So, and unless we address those, and those perverse incentives, it's not going to help. So, for instance, the example that you've come up with, where either through protocols, you know that if there's a certain accident, the amount of compensation is determined, it's deterministic, it's an exact amount. That will take away most of the legal battles. In fact, one of the things that the REF that we're pushing for is to say, remove the subjectivity in determining the compensation that somebody's entitled to. Don't leave it to experts to argue and on matters where, in reality, not even the court, nobody can tell the future. Why don't we come up with a scheme where you're saying, if you've had this type of accident, this is a fixed amount that you get. Once you do that, you get away from all these perverse incentives, so people hold out and think it's going to be more and more and more. So I think we subscribe to it, and we really would have liked to have seen arbitration work more. But I think it shows that there's fundamental problems in the scheme that also needs to be addressed. And I hope that answers that part of the question. There actually have been, I know I've got a lot of questions to deal with. Do you want to deal with the Amendment Act first before I deal with the other questions?
Chairperson, I can deal with the Amendment Act. I think the critical issue that we just need to be very contentious about is that we have past historic challenges, and then we have present challenges. And then we have addressed the system to a large extent, dealing with those challenges last year. But now the impact of those historic challenges will still be felt in years to come. Now, I would like to specifically refer to slide 39, if we can get that back, just outlining the changes. It's not all of them, though, but most of them, the most important ones. We changed the system to be implemented for all claims from 1 August 2008. We limited claims, the so-called cappings that we referred. However, we need to be conscientious of the financial impact over a period. Within the fault-based system as we have it now, the question is, can the RAF financially be sustainable with the income it is presently deriving from the fuel levy as it is? And the answer is yes. But if it must, with that income, with the existing system, also pay for the backlogged claims, it is not possible. And that is why we do not have a proper entity in the financial sense. I would like to suggest that we be very careful and responsible when we make changes to the system. The department will and is, in fact, looking at various options. We need to make sure that we address the comprehensive social security issues that we are trying to integrate in this country. Whatever we find the proper funding system to be for the Road Accident Fund, it needs to speak to the national priorities. If we are going to up the fuel levy, we will have the unfair impact on future generations paying for past mistakes. If we say no, that we need to revisit the whole funding system of the Road Accident Fund, we are back with a comprehensive social security challenge. So what we are saying is, yes, we definitely need to and is already considering various changes to the system. However, as we are sitting here today, we need to acknowledge that the RAF will be, with its income it's presently receiving, with the new claims coming in from 1st August 2008, will be able to survive financially. I'm not saying it's addressing all the other challenges within the legal fraternity and also within the medical service fraternity. But what I'm saying is that we need, and this is why we are here today, we need the support of this portfolio committee to address the backlog. To ask for $2.5 billion every year is not going to help. We need to address the $40 billion backlog somehow and to have a funding model to pay for this retrospectively will never work, and that is the view of the department. Thank you.
Yeah, perhaps just to finalize it, the two issues relating to changes that we're wanting to face. And I think this committee will find those sort of challenges moving forward. There are very strong interest groups that would rather have the system stay as it is. Because there's a lot of money involved here. If you think about it, it's not just $2.5 billion. It's monies that are taken through contingency fees. And in fact, you know, if you think of it, the president had signed the Amendment Act into law in 2005, that we only were able to get it effective from the 1st of August 2008, is because every single step that we take, the Law Society has sought to challenge everything that we did. And in fact, the initial constitutional challenge related to something that was just administrative. I mean, all the department had sought to do was just publish changes, promulgate the changes that related to administrative aspects of the Act, and that administrative aspect related to appointment of directors and that sort of thing. And because initially a wrong clause was referred to, with the president corrected, it just got stuck for 2 years in the Constitutional Court. And I think by the Law Society and by the way, okay. Oh yeah, Kruger. I think lawyer Kruger. I think the Law Society. But I think all the attorneys would love for all the changes to take as long as possible. And by the way, these amendments are also being challenged. The main body of the amendments are also subject to challenges by the Law Society again. And their hope is that it will again take as long as possible and that sort of thing. So we're hoping that the committee shows strength because any changes in legislation will be challenged. There's too much money involved and we're going to require strength as relates to it. And perhaps quickly dealing with the rest of the other questions, we do find we have an arrangement with the NPA and the commercial trans units of the South African Police Service, where we work together to look at attorneys that are dishonest, and doctors, and that sort of thing. And ever so often we report those attorneys to the Law Society. And in certain cases, action is taken. But the problem, though, is this is just a scratch on the surface. In reality, we don't actually have the detailed stats on how many of the attorneys are being taken off the role by the Law Society because of dishonesty and that. And perhaps coming to the honourable member, the new questions, the statistics, and I have to certainly acknowledge your personal experience. That in fact, one of the reasons why we are changing and retraining all our staff is that I couldn't stand here and say that we're treating our claims, extended victims, giving them the customer services they deserve. Again, it's been years of, I think, incorrect training and dealing with the arrears. It's not easy, and that's why we have created a brand new robotics and functions, brand new services and procedures. And then we are completely retraining the staff and putting customer services network. And that's because our staff, as I said earlier, very few of our staff members have ever met an accident victim All they see is pieces of paper. It's like a number. And we want to change that. The reason we haven't gone publicly with a big communication campaign is we wanted to go get our act together first. We wanted to make sure that our systems and processes are in place. Then when victims do come to us, that they don't have the disappointment that they have had to date. And as such, a lot of work has been done. And when we roll out the claims administration solution, we're hoping that it will obviously be accompanied by a big public campaign to encourage excellent victims to come directly to us. The question of what the changes and what is the hold up, because it's costing the economy billions of rands, we mainly interest groups. We have 7 commissions of inquiries, and to be honest, the interest groups have been pretty strong in this regard, and they will continue to be strong. But I think this renewed political will, and we're hoping that this committee will start looking at a new raft of legislation that will begin to address some of the problems. And remember, these problems are not unique to us, and they're not hard to solve. All it requires is just the will to just put in the legislation and change things. Even if people fight and scream and take it to constitutional court, we're quite satisfied though that as long as it's justifiable in an open and democratic society, some of these changes will pass the constitutional muster. I think we've got, one of the most admirable constitutions that cannot allow for, ordinary South Africans to continue to be robbed in this manner. And we're hoping that some of those changes will continue. Now, on the contingency fee, the 25%, I think the question that was raised by, honourable member there was, why is it so difficult to get for the REF to help, accident victims as it relates to, telling them how much the REF has settled for. I think it's sad that some of the staff members are not able to do so, because all we need is just a claim number or an ID to go into the system and say, this is how much the road accident fund has settled. There is no reason why we should be asking anybody who comes to us and ask for that information. There's no reason why we should be saying, go ask your attorney. In fact, it is wrong if staff members are continuing to do so. And I think that reflects the sort of training that we need to start doing with our staff members. One of the things that we actually have been considering doing, because we've been wanting to be proactive, and because we had failed in our attempt to go and communicate directly with the accident victims. If you recall, we lost the court case in Cape Town here, where we were not allowed to pay compensation directly to the accident victims, the direct payment system. We've actually been toying with the idea of making regular public announcements and this sort of thing. In this regard, we believe South Africans do deserve to know how much compensation has been given to them, and that that information will allow them to make the right decision. Interest in the trust account, that interest unfortunately never gets into the hands of the accident victim. One of the things that I think attorneys have been hiding behind is it's very convenient to say, listen, it's taking 5-10 years to process your claim because REF is inefficient and this sort of thing. And even at a time after, when we paid accident victims, lawyers just sit with the money and sit. And because accident victims have got no mechanism to go and deal directly with us, or have not been empowered to do so, that excuse has been very, very convenient to the law society and that. But the sad part is that if the money is in the trust account, the interest goes to the law society. If the money is in the attorney's own bank account, rather than give that interest to the accident victim. In our experience, we find that accident victims don't even get that interest. And that's the sadness in this scheme being so, not very transparent and as complex as it is. How long does it take, if everything went well, how long would it take to claim from the RAF? I think one of the big handicaps is the fact that it's a fault-based scheme. You need to prove two things: who was at fault, and that again requires traversing complex legal issues. To be quite honest, to think that, Google somewhere in Gokstad or whatever the case is going to know how they're going to prove fault, really is asking a little too much, and that's why this game is very complex. But also to go and calculate quantum and go to present values of your future income. I mean, it requires actually, this scheme is just too complex and too subjective. And that's what takes time. But according to our Act, we should be processing claims within 120 days. This is the sort of indication of the timing that is already in our Act. However, in reality, just to get a court date takes 18 months and that sort of thing. In fact, one of the courts are very unhappy that, the court role is cluttered with RAF matters. It just takes much more than 120 days to process claims. If we had a scheme where accident victims did not have to prove fault, we should be able to say to someone who is injured and lying there, in the middle of the street, that we're going to pay the ambulance immediately. That we don't have to go and find out who is at fault and who's not at fault. And we should be able to say to the ambulance groups, please pick that individual up because you are guaranteed you're going to get paid. At the moment, they don't want to do so because they're not guaranteed that they're going to get paid. And because of the involvement of the court processes, all of those at time. Again, is the fundamental flaws in our scheme. Let's bring in no fault. I think you're going to find, though, that we achieve our social objectives. And by the way, one of the studies, all these studies on the impact of accidents on society, all of them will say to you that, this golden hour, the first few minutes, if you can give somebody medical attention right at the beginning, you are going to be saving ongoing costs to society forever, and you're going to actually be saving lives. And that's what we would prefer to do. We do have, public outreach programs, but we haven't done, as much communication as we'd like because we wanted to get our team together. And just on the issue of overseas travel and whether we need, why is it that when we travel as South Africans overseas, we take extra insurance, and we don't require that to be done for foreign visitors visiting South Africa. I think it's an important point. And in fact, why is it that people are not paying extra for it? Obviously two aspects to it. Our constitution is, I think we've got one of the, pretty good Bill of Rights, and our constitution does actually give protection to anybody who finds themselves here, even if you're a foreigner. And there's a starting point. However, it doesn't stop us from having policies that allow us to charge a little bit more, making sure that some of the limits are imposed in terms of claiming in your own currency and this sort of thing. That 160,000 limit, although it's in rand, you still calculate it in your own currency. And by the way, there's a misunderstanding on the 160,000. It doesn't mean that all claims are limited to 160. In fact, people do get paid millions of rands as a result of this, because if you still have 35 years to go, you have to multiply the 150 by the remaining lives that you have. So we still have, we still pay millions in this regard. It's just a loss per annum that we're paying. That house, I think we need to find a mechanism in law to remove this abuse. We call them ambulance chasers. It's really sad that you know, the legal profession does pounce on unsuspecting public and use the ignorance to get them to sign things that stop them from actually even understanding the scheme. I do agree with you. You have cards sitting in hospitals and issuing cards and even phoning you. You know, I've even myself got involved in an accident, in a tiny little accident, the CEO, and I've had phone calls. And I've said, but where did you get my number from? And, you know, and obviously not knowing who I am, they've been saying, you know, please come and plan through us and whatever the case is. And all you need to do is sign a piece of paper and you forget about it. We do everything. And this is how our people are taking for a ride, because, you know, I think some of the attendees are pretty aggressive and they use tals. But often this also leads to fraud, because people use this to create sort of fraudulent claims. It leads to rural areas and people involved in accidents in tractors. You know, just for clarity, if a tractor is used to plow the field, say in the farm, and then there's an accident during the course of business, that is covered through the occupational health and safety sort of claims. However, if the tractor happens to find itself on a road, maybe moving between two farms, and then it gets involved in an accident, there is a claim from us. The one distinction, though, is when I think farmers do claim for the rebate. You know, that distinction is not made. So, unfortunately, there are elements where we pay anyway. You know, even when, you know, I think some of the farmers with those tractors did not, you know, really pay for the cover in field levy. Unruly vehicles, speeding, alcohol, do we get, you know, accident victims to pay? You know, one of the things that we said the scheme ought to do is to reflect what society feels about certain of the things, like crime and this sort of thing. Somebody could be involved in a cash heist and then get involved in an accident. In this scheme, they claim from us. Even if you know, got injured in the course of conducting a crime and that. And I think, you know, a lot of other schemes in other jurisdictions have started to put limits on some of these. And the principle is, it's a clear and fair one. What it says is, when you are lying there in the street and you're pleading, we don't want to be asking questions. So we want to save your life. Even if perhaps you were drunk or you were speeding or whatever the case is. But beyond that, you should not be able to benefit from the crimes that you've committed. And that's a principle that, in fact, as we write the new legislation, we need to ensure that continues. That is actually inculcated in our scheme. That, in fact, we do focus on saving people's lives, even if you're an illegal immigrant or whatever the case is. However, you should not then suddenly get additional benefits as it relates to that. And then there's no compensation for part of them. Oh, did I miss? I believe I missed two or three questions. We need to share successes or challenges experiencing following a change from Central Energy Fund to collecting from SARS. The one thing that pertained at the time that we had a Central Energy Fund was collecting the field levy is that it was collecting at wholesale, number one. And there was always questions of, you know, lack of payment, debtors, and all those sort of stuff. And to be quite honest, the benefit of moving the collection to the refinery meant that you only get paid from fewer people. So in terms of money collected from the refinery, you get money from I think there's so many refineries in the country, so you get money quicker, and the question of bad debt and that sort of thing is very small. So those are some of the successes. I think there have been disadvantages. I think this matter has been driven largely by National Treasury and South African Revenue Services, because they had found, though, that they were repaying the diesel rebate, quite large amounts of diesel rebate. And in terms of getting the money back from us because of the limited funding that we're getting, there wasn't sufficient cash for them to be refunded. So I think National Treasury just wanted to have control of both elements of the income and the diesel rebate. I think the one disadvantage, though, is we lost, say, 2.5 months. It takes, on average, 2.5 months for that money to reach our coffers. In the past, when it was through the Central Energy Fund, it used to come within a month of collection. Now, the law has been written in a manner that it allows the refineries to do an audit and for this check to be done and that check. So by the time you receive the money, it's 2.5 months. So that's some of the disadvantage. We're sitting with 2 billion in unpaid monies in our balance sheet. The board, the term has expired, and I was going to let DOT talk about the expiry of the board term. I think the minister has published again nominations. The nomination closed on the 31st of August, this month, on Friday. And I'm sure DOT can talk about the remaining processes from then on. The term of the board has expired. Do you want to add to the board?
There's nothing more actually to add. We have an interim board attending to the fiduciary duties, and we will, as soon as possible, after the candidates have been shortlisted, follow the legislative process of appointment.
One last question on funeral costs. The reason the funeral costs are too low is a reflection of two things. As we indicated, there's a ratio of 1 to 20. We only pay funeral costs for people who pass away, but the biggest payments we make are people who are injured. I think that's one of the reasons why, in proportionate terms, it's lower. But there is no fixed amount that we pay. I think what the Act says is that we pay, reasonable cost of internment and that sort of thing. So, some people bury, other people, cremate and that sort of thing. So there is no hard and fast sort of rule. So we don't pay fixed amount. We just pay whatever is being claimed. Thank you, madam.
Thank you very much. May I again take this opportunity to thank you for presenting to us a report and a solution that seeks to address the challenges. And I've listened to the comments of most of the members. Everybody saying it's a good plan. You have also asked for our intervention in relation to legislation, as well as ensuring that the financing challenges that are required to deal with the backlog are actually addressed. You are also highlighting that there is a lack of awareness of the rights and the benefits of the Road Accident Fund from the third world part of our society. I only say this because we have two worlds in one in South Africa. We have the first world that is informed, rich, have access to information, and we have the third world that is poor, uninformed, and no access to information. And I must commend you. It is a very rare situation that a CEO of an entity or a department would present challenges as they are and not want to portray a situation of that the entity is doing well. Your presentation is different in the sense that you are not talking about what you have done, the good things that you are doing within a system that is not good. You are talking, you are analyzing the system, the service, how it is supposed to benefit the accident victim. And you are pointing out at the flaws and the challenges that need to be addressed. And you are also presenting a good plan of how you think those things can be addressed. And you are also pointing out to us what is required of us to do to make that plan work. Because a plan remains a plan until it is implemented. So a plan is not the end result. And we hear you very well when you are saying there is this plan. But for it to work, there is also some work that needs to be done by all of us seated here. Mr. Modise, you have a very good plan. One thing that you have also mentioned is the issue of the no-fault policy. A question that is not directed to you but the department is how far are we with the legal process of the no-fault policy? Where are we with it? When are we likely to have the no-fault policy operating? Because this plan also depends on that. That is one question to the department. We are also saying that work is not done until there is time pressure. Why is there such a culture? Have you analyzed that and come up with maybe possible solutions to change the culture? The other issue for me is what I've been observing. I related last time when you were here that I had a brother who passed away in 1983 through a car accident. He was the breadwinner, he was the father of six children. He never got a cent. Some of his children were very young at that time. I've seen a lot of adverts on the public broadcaster about insurance. Why is RIF not advertising? Why is there no education that tells the community out there, like it happens with other insurance companies that are advertising all the time, how good they are? Why is this one, that is government, it is of government, and it is aimed at assisting the victims to meet the cost, the hospital cost, and also to get compensated? Why is there no advert, when also the broadcaster belongs to the government? The second issue that I want to raise is, why are our constituency offices not used? If I was not serving in this portfolio committee, I would not have all this information. How many members of parliament here, all of them that have constituency offices, and these accidents happen where they live? Why is such a facility that exists not used? And if education maybe is expensive or whatever, it can be done, rolled out to communities, why are there no presentations to members of parliament so that they can be utilized as public representatives to spread the gospel and educate the people? We also have multi-purpose centers that are sometimes standing there idle and empty. And these multi-purpose centers are in wards. There is no ward that does not have a multi-purpose center. And we have ward committees that are moving around and getting paid by government. Why are we not utilizing the ward committees to actually educate the communities? Because already they are getting paid. And there are multi-purpose centers in the communities. There are community halls that are underutilized. Why are we not using them? Distribution of flyers is in pension pay points. Distribution of flyers in schools. I was part of the voter education team in 1994. And one of the communication strategies that we used was music tapes that were played in the taxis and the buses. And everybody, it was the first democratic election. People did not know how to vote, what to do, what will qualify them as voters. And we used that. Just a tape with songs and then the message. And it was very, very effective. The last thing, what relationship exists between the Road Accident Fund and Transport CETA? Because what we hear on the other side is that money is underspent that is meant for training with the CETA. And on this side, we have an awareness campaign that has not been implemented. There is a need for an awareness campaign. There is a need for educating the communities about their rights. And we hear of accidents. I attended a funeral in the Eastern Cape where a bus accident had 19 people killed. When I was a deputy mayor in Ugu, a truck got involved in an accident and collided with a combi, and 15 people died, workers, a loss of income was experienced by their communities. Why do we see agents in the hospital that are not the community workers, that are not from the constituency offices of the members of parliament, that are not from your offices, but agencies that are moving in each and every ward and looking for people that are injured, sent by the legal fraternity. The last thing, it is very, very unfortunate that the legal fraternity in this country, especially the law society, would continue to commercialize the misery of the people and fight to have the system unchanged because it serves their interest and their greed for money. With no benefits to the communities and the public that we serve. Why is this carrying on 15 years into democracy? I'm not saying you are not doing anything, but I am questioning the attitude of the legal fraternity, particularly the law society, to say money for them is more important than the people. The scheme was not designed to benefit them, but they can use all the legal muscles to have the system unchanged so that they can continue to benefit while other people are suffering. Why is the misery of the people in this country so much commercialized? Are material resources more important than people? And I think this portfolio committee would need to look at much biting laws so as to deal with that. I would leave it at that, and most of the things that I said don't require a response. There are just a few questions that you would need to respond to.
Thank you, Mr. Grossman, for policy. Yes, where we are with the no-fault policy, we've drafted no-fault policy. We responded to the Cabinet's questions coming from 2006 regarding the constitutionality, the financial impact, the operational impact, and quite a lot of other sectors that will be affected, in particular the health sector and also the social development area, and particularly social security. However, the process that we will follow, it will be tabled as a draft to the appropriate cluster dealing with social security on the 9th of September. It will be tabled for comment, and so we will also advise appropriate principles that we would like to request public comment ASAP. It will be very important that we note that to move a whole system, and this is not the debate today, but I just want to flag this, to change a whole system from fault to no fault, apart from agreeing on the concept, which we can easily do in the smaller group, we also need to address responsibly the impact that it will have on the industry at large and on the citizens out there. We need to see how health will manage the way that we will constitute no fault, etc. So there are a lot of issues that we will debate in this particular committee at a later stage. But now we first need to go back and draft that document responsibly. We've already consulted with internal stakeholders, and the RAF, of course, is one of the major role players. It's there. I don't think it, I actually believe it's premature to now commit to the contents and details of such a policy prior to our principals having endorsed it. But yes, dear, that is where we are.
Madam Chair, I really have to thank you for a lot of the questions and comments, because they highlight and indicate areas where we could do better, especially as it relates to communication and reaching, you know, unreached audiences out there. And most of the points we will take to heart, but there has one or two issues to address, and maybe even before I address that, you know, before I was appointed the CEO of the RES, I had been involved in so many accidents, I didn't even know there was an organization called RES that I could claim from and that sort of thing. And, you know, and in that regard, there's so much that we as a fund should be doing to make sure that all the South Africans are aware of the benefits and what they're entitled to. But just two just quick issues. Why do people only work when there's time pressure? You know, historically, because the scheme allowed REF to pay all the legal costs, there was always this diversity incentive that, you know, the costs are paid for by REF. So for as long as it takes, if it takes an expert that you could deal with just in a meeting, you're going to write 10 or 20 letters and elongate the process because you maximize payments to you and both panel members and plaintiff attorneys, because REF covers all the costs. There was never really an incentive for people to deal with matters sooner. So there's a number of reasons why you know, people have taken so long and why this culture evolved over time. It's unintended consequences of REF, of the law saying REF will pay, you know, all the legal costs, even if it's on a party and party basis. But that's some of the reasons. But it's areas that we want him to, I think, to address. And I think all your points on communications and fires and that sort of thing we will deal with. We may not have direct relationship with CETA, but it's something that we're going to look at. And there's no reason why we should not be investing in communication. In fact, the way we look at the education and communication to the public, it's an investment. It's an investment not only in safe use of our roads and that sort of thing. Not only would we be communicating what communities are entitled to, but we'll probably also be communicating how to safely use roads and that. And the areas where we've begun to invest in teaching children at school and that sort of thing, but it's still too small. It's still, at this point in time, a drop in the ocean. But all those comments will definitely be taken into account, Madam Chair. And thank you.
Thank you very much. I think it was a very good meeting. You were very good in your presentation and also the response to questions. You are not hiding anything. We are very happy with the report. We will be revisiting areas that need to be revisited. And from our side, we would also want to commit ourselves in that we will be looking at the issues that you requested us to intervene on, and you will be informed of the progress that we are making on our side. We do want this plan to be implemented, and for it also to yield the required and desired results. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for inviting us.
We are now going to be dealing with the minutes of the previous meeting. But before we do that, there are apologies that we needed to take. Can we have those apologies? The Minister of Transport sent an apology together with the DG for Transport. They are in a joint cabinet meeting, and Mr. Poho from COPE also sent an apology. He is there. Can we have a mover and a seconder for the acceptance of the apology? Thank you. We are now considering the minutes of the previous meeting. We are on page 1. The meeting was on the 18th of August, 2009. We are on page 1, page 2, page 3, and page 4. Can we have the mover and the seconder for the adoption of the minutes? Thank you. The meeting is declared closed. Thank you.
Gracias.